Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 167. It's Monday, June 13th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, we're going to start with just a little bit of COVID-19 and then a whole bunch of not COVID-19. I guess that's good. I want to start with a very interesting story, this from Medical Express. Study says COVID-19 accounted for 62% of duty-related law enforcement deaths in 2020. COVID-19 accounted for 62% of the 295 duty-related law enforcement deaths reported in 2020 to the National Law Enforcement Officer Memorial Fund database, which tracks law enforcement officers who died in the line of duty, according to a new University of Buffalo study. The study, published in Policing, an international journal, also found that COVID-19 accounted for 82% of deaths among Black members of law enforcement and 77% of deaths in Latinx officers, far higher than the 48% of deaths among white police officers. So I reported on this earlier, but this is, you know, as the pandemic goes on, we can get the full data. So, basically the interesting thing here is that COVID-19 was the biggest threat, the biggest lethal threat to law enforcement in 2020. It's not the bad guys. It's the virus. So what's going on with COVID-19? Get a little update here from the New York Times. Two new versions of Omicron are gaining grounds in the U.S. according to CDC estimates. The Omicron subvariants known as BA4 and BA5 now represent 13% of new coronavirus cases in the United States, up from 7.5% a week ago and 1% in early May, according to new estimates from the CDC. The subvariants have become especially common in parts of the southern United States. In the region comprising Arkansas, Louisiana, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas, BA4 and BA5 accounted for more than 1 in 5 infections, according to the new figures. Preliminary evidence from laboratory research suggests that unvaccinated people who were infected with the original version of Omicron, known as BA1, might be easily reinfected by BA4 or BA5. Vaccinated people are likely to fare somewhat better, the study suggests. This immune evasiveness, in addition to the natural waning of protection against infection over time, could explain why the newest subvariants have been able to spread so quickly. And as sort of a summary, BA1, the original Omicron that raged through in December, January, February, creating the largest surge in cases that we've had, that's basically been gone for about a month. It's no longer present. BA2 is now the dominant one, and it rose to dominance in less than 2 months. But now here we're seeing BA4 and BA5 raise their ugly heads, and this is likely to be dominant in a month or two. So we're seeing that basically each new variant is basically lasting a couple months and then being overtaken by another one. Oh. Well, COVID-19 continues to throw us curveballs. Okay, well, let's get to the Lucas County local COVID-19 update. To provide context, the hot spots in the nation are shifting from the Northeast and Midwest to the South and the West. And nationally, we're getting a slow burn, which is rising slowly. Kind of the background story in these last couple weeks or couple months has been that the quality of COVID-19 data surveillance has decreased a lot. And perhaps a little ironically, some of that's due to the success of widespread home testing. But the mass majority of home tests are never reported, either negatives or positives, to authorities. So the actual tests that get reported, there's probably at least 10 times as many more actual cases. So what do we see in Lucas County? The most recent figures was 92 cases a day identified. And again, that's probably closer to like 1,000 cases a day, which would mean something on the order that, you know, 1% of Lucas County residents are positive any given week. So that's, you know, up there with transmission rates that we've seen just about any time in the pandemic. Of course, there's a lot of unknowns in this. The testing positivity rate in Lucas County does seem to have gone down a bit. It went down to 12% from 16.4% the week before. That's still pretty terrible testing positivity rate, but it could be going in the right direction. The amount of testing has declined slightly locally. In Ohio, unfortunately, the testing positivity rate has gone up from 15.8% to 17%. Nationally, it's also, stayed about the same, about 13.5% to 13.4%. But nationally, the big story there is that when you take the nation as a whole, the volume of testing has really dropped a lot in the last week or two, and it seems to be continuing to drop. This is for a lot of reasons. People are kind of done with the pandemic, but also the feds have really gotten out of the testing business. They're not subsidizing or paying for people's tests, particularly those that are uninsured or low income. So we're seeing a lot less of the PCR tests. And of course, many folks are not going to dish out for private tests. Okay, well, one area we do have more regular testing is nursing homes or long-term care facilities. We saw a slight decline from 88 to 71 active cases in Lucas County in the most recent week. That's 47 residents and 24 staff with active COVID cases. We didn't have any more deaths among long-term care facility residents, so that's good. Hospitalizations in Lucas County, Ohio, and U.S. are all rising, but slowly. The U.S. had about a 10% increase in hospitalizations in the last 2 weeks. Deaths seem to be hovering nationally, tend to be hovering around 350 per day. Not great, but at least it's not skyrocketing. So there you have it. Plenty of COVID out there. Should still take some efforts to protect yourself. But fortunately, it does seem that the hospitalizations deaths are not rising really quickly. So it seems to be this kind of slow burn. Slow doesn't necessarily mean we're at a low level, but at least we're not in this kind of overt epidemic thing where we're seeing rapid rises. But as these new variants come in over the next couple months, we're going to see another wave. And who knows, the way it looks like, that could start right back over again in the Northeast once they've gotten out of this wave and come back to us, obviously, in the Midwest as well. Okay, well, let's go big and look at some other hot public health issues. I want to do a story on gun rights here and then one on abortion. This first one from PBS. Support for gun rights has eroded after nearly a decade of mass shootings, polls show. 6 out of 10 Americans think it is more important to control gun violence and protect gun rights, a significant rise over the last decade evident in the latest PBS NewsHour NPR Marist poll. As mass shootings continue to erupt across the U.S., and as midterm elections approach, 7 of 10 people say they are more likely to vote in November after last month's mass shooting at a school in Uvalde, Texas, and a grocery store in Buffalo, New York. In this latest poll, roughly 3/4 of voters would throw their support behind a candidate for Congress who would work to enact red flag laws. That includes 6 out of 10 Republicans and gun owners, as well as about half of all Trump 2020 voters, nearly all Democrats, and most independents. Research shows that this measure makes a difference. Nearly all registered voters, 86%, said they would back a congressional candidate who supports more funding for mental health screenings and treatment. That support remained regardless of politics, age, race, income, education, geography, or gun ownership. 56% of registered voters said they want to ban the sale of semi-automatic assault weapons, including the AR-15, which was the style of weapon used in both Uvalde and Buffalo. While nearly all Democrats supported such a move, independents were split, while only 1/3 of Republicans backed the measure. In this latest poll, 81% of U.S. registered voters, including nearly all Democrats and about 3/4 of Republicans, independents, and gun owners, said they would vote for a candidate for Congress who wants to require background checks for gun purchases at gun shows or other private sales. So while some days it seems the things don't change, the times are changing and shifting, hopefully for the better. Of course, one hot topic that is definitely not going the right direction is abortion. And this story from Politico accents that. Six predictions about the end of Roe based on research. One, wealthy Americans will still get abortions. Lower income Americans will have children at the wrong time. There is a slogan based on the experiences of pre-Roe America that says, you can't ban abortion, you can only ban safe abortion. But the Turnaway study suggests a more nuanced outcome than a proliferation of back alley abortions. In states that ban abortion, people with the information, financial resources, and physical capability will travel hundreds of miles to get an abortion in another state, or find a way to access medication abortion pills online. These abortions will be as safe as if they had occurred in their own state, as long as it doesn't take people too long to get them. But people without the means to circumvent their state's laws will give birth instead. My conservative estimate, based on studies of other restrictions on abortion, is that a quarter of those who would previously have been able to get an abortion will instead give birth. Already in the United States, thousands of people who want abortions can't get them. Abortion bans will sharply increase this number. Two, people who are pregnant and don't want to will face serious physical health risks. Abortion foes often talk about the health risks of ending a pregnancy, but in fact, our research found that abortion poses many fewer physical risks than full-term pregnancy. Some people forced to carry a pregnancy to term will die. This is not hypothetical. Two young women in our study who had sought and had been denied abortions died as a result of their pregnancies. This tragic outcome will become more common when we are talking about as many as 100,000 people unable to get abortion and carrying unwanted pregnancies to term. In the U.S., we are already facing a crisis of maternal mortality, whereby American women, particularly black women, die at rates far higher than those of other developed countries. For those who don't experience serious medical complications, pregnancy still has significant lasting effects on health. The pregnant body literally depletes and reshapes itself to create a new being, taking calcium from bones, increasing blood volume, lowering immune defenses to tolerate the new occupant, and rearranging internal organs, muscles, ligaments, and bones. The consequences for physical health persist for the rest of one's life. We saw that in this study, women who carried their pregnancies to term reported a higher incidence of hypertension and chronic pain and a greater likelihood of poor health compared to those who received an abortion. 3. Few people will place their children for adoption. During oral arguments in December of last year, Amy Coney Barrett suggested that women could simply drop off their newborns at hospitals or fire stations to be adopted by other families. The Turnaway study suggests results indicate that there will be no great increase in the, quote, domestic supply of infants for adoption. We found that when someone has gone through the literally life-threatening process of staying pregnant and giving birth, the vast majority, about 90%, chose to parent the child. 4. More unwanted births now will result in fewer wanted births later. Based on the Turnaway study findings, I do not anticipate that banning abortion will result in a large increase in the total number of children born. Yes, in states that ban abortion, approximately a quarter of women who otherwise would get an abortion will give birth, but these births will come at the cost of people having wanted pregnancies later. Banning abortion means that people have children before they're ready and then are less likely to have children later, either because they have had all the children they can care for or because, although they may want more children, their life circumstances don't improve to a point where they can do so. 5. Those unable to get an abortion will experience economic hardship and curtailed life ambitions. It is not news that having children is expensive, but the experience of people who can't travel because of cost or illness is going to be about more than just the difficulty of being a parent on limited incomes. The Turnaway study shows that when women can't get abortions, they are less financially stable. They are less likely to be able to work a full-time job. They are more likely to receive public assistance, but not enough to keep their families above the poverty level. Years later, those denied abortions are still more likely than those who receive them to not have enough money for basic living needs. They have higher debt and are more likely to have been evicted. One of the most poignant findings of the study is that both life satisfaction and self-esteem drop when someone is denied an abortion. Having control over childbearing affects one's assessments and enjoyment of life. Women who have abortions more often go on to accomplish other life goals, such as finding a full-time job, finding more satisfying romantic relationships, and achieving other aspirational plans. 6. More children will be raised in poverty and strain. The Turnaway study found that children born because their mother was denied an abortion were more likely to live in poverty and their mothers report worse emotional bonding with the children than children born later to women who managed to get an abortion. The data also show that women's existing children suffer when women lose control over the circumstances and timing of subsequent births. These older children are more likely to live in poverty and less likely to achieve developmental milestones. And I would just add to that last one, we have to remember that most abortions occur in women who already have children. So it affects those children as well. Okay, well, political differences and political contention does seem to lead to poor health. And this next article gets at that. This is from Kaiser Health News. A deep dive into the widening mortality gap across the political aisle. A study published in the British Medical Journal examined mortality rates and voting patterns in the past five presidential elections and found that people who lived in jurisdictions that consistently voted Democratic fared better than those who voted Republican. We will aspire to live in and exist in a sort of system where politics and health don't intersect, said Dr. Hader Varick, the study's lead author. But what the paper actually shows is that politics and health, especially in the United States, are deeply intertwined. Overall, from 2001 to 2019, they found that Democratic counties did better in reducing their age-adjusted mortality rates. During that period, the rate dropped by 22%, from 850 to 664 deaths for every 100,000 residents annually, compared with 11% dip in Republican counties, down to 771 deaths for every 100,000 residents. So when you compare the absolute difference, there's actually the Democratic counties are 22% less likely to die than those that live in Republican counties. So there you go. There's a tax of a different sort. The bottom line, the mortality gap in Republican voting counties compared with Democrat voting counties has grown over time. My fear is that gap will grow even more after the pandemic, Varick said. Now remember, all this data was before the pandemic. Varick emphasized that health policies are not the only factors that shape a community's well-being. It's going to be the economic conditions of those regions. It's going to be the educational environments. It's going to be the health behaviors, and it's going to be health policy as well, he said. So what we're seeing is really the cumulative effect of a whole lot of different things. The researchers, for instance, pointed to a previous study showing that more liberal state policies on tobacco control, labor, immigration, civil rights, and environmental protections were associated with better life expectancy, whereas more conservative state policies, such as restrictions on abortion and less stringent gun laws, were associated with lower life expectancy among women. Left-leaning states were also more likely to enact policies such as Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, which sought to widen the safety net for vulnerable populations. Of 12 states that have not expanded their Medicaid programs, 9 have Republican governors and 10 voted for former President Donald Trump in 2020. The mortality rate patterns between Republican and Democratic counties were generally consistent among racial and ethnic subgroups, such as non-Hispanic Black Americans and Hispanic people. But Black Americans had a higher mortality rate than any other race or ethnicity, regardless of the political persuasion of the county they lived in. The gap was most striking among white Americans. The death rate of white residents in Democratic counties, according to the study, dropped by 15% from 2001 to 2019. Meanwhile, white residents in Republican counties saw just a 3% dip. Rural Republican counties experienced the highest age-adjusted mortality rates and the least improvement. This might be a little ironic, but probably proves the truth that white supremacy will eventually kill itself as well. Now again, remember, this study did not talk about the pandemic, and I've reported earlier a number of times about the wide gap in mortality between red and blue counties for COVID-19, so we'd expect that these would be this mortality gap would accelerate quite a bit over the last couple years. So, as an example of what's happened just in the last couple years, is when you compare the United States versus peer countries, the U.S. lost over 2 years of life expectancy in 2020 to 2021 during the pandemic. And compared to the peer countries, that increased the gap in life expectancy to 5 years, meaning that Americans die 5 years earlier than peer countries. We can do better. Well, if you find that death tax taxing, I'm going to do a series of stories here on mental health. First up from Medical Express, 4 in 10 U.S. adults who need mental health care can't get it, says survey. There is a staggering gap between the number of Americans who need care for anxiety, depression, and other mental health conditions and those who can actually get it, a new survey shows. In all, 42% of U.S. adults who needed care in the previous 12 months did not get it because of costs and other barriers, according to a survey from the National Council for Mental Well-Being. Nearly one quarter said they needed help for substance use. In the new survey, about 21% said they had trouble accessing primary health care when they needed it, but more than twice as many had difficulty getting needed mental health or substance use treatment. About 37% of respondents who said they needed mental health care in the survey said the expense had prevented them from getting it, be it out-of-pocket costs or lack of insurance. This was also true for 31% of those needing substance use care. 28% of respondents said they were unable to find a conveniently located provider, as did 22% of those needing substance use care, the survey found. Respondents also struggled to find a provider who offered care in the way they were comfortable with, be it in person or virtually. About 50% of respondents said the lack of care had led to personal relationship issues. About 45% reported work issues, and 44% noted a decline in their mental well-being. For those who needed but were unable to get substance use care, 49% related work issues as a result, 43% cited relationship issues, and 37% a decline in their mental well-being. Men were more likely than women to need substance use care, the survey found. People between 18 and 41 years of age were more likely than older people to need both mental health and substance use care. Cultural issues were a key concern. Roughly 6 in 10 adults agreed that there are too few mental health providers trained to address specific issues such as race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, or economic status. Even respondents who said they did access care had trouble getting what they needed, including 67% of those who received mental health care and 81% of those treated for substance use, the survey found. Citing insurance-related issues, about 3 in 5 said they thought it would be easier and faster to get help if they paid for mental health care out of pocket. Many insurers are not complying with the mental health parity legislation passed a decade ago. The cost of mental health and substance use care should not be any higher or less affordable to access than general medical care. We've had a nationwide parity legislation for over a decade, and the biggest problem is that we're struggling on enforcement. This is one of the big failures, I think, in our healthcare system. 10 years out, when nationally passed a law that says you cannot treat mental health and substance use behavioral disorders different from physical health issues, that is not the case. Okay, well, let's drill down a little bit into some of the barriers for getting mental health treatment and care. This from MedPage Today. Reasons why most young adults sweep depression under the rug. Over the last decade, more than half of young adults with depression reported not receiving treatment, and important reasons were related to cost and stigma. Cost of care was the most common problem for young patients with major depressive episodes, and the frequency of cost being cited as a barrier to mental health care going up from 51% in 2011 to 55% in 2019. During that period, the proportion of young people saying that they had inadequate insurance for treatment also increased from 7% to 16%. Other barriers to care included people not knowing where to go for treatment, worrying about confidentiality, not wanting to take medication, and not having the time. Of course, this is no real great news that cost is the biggest barrier and bottleneck to receiving mental health care services. This might be advantaged by getting universal health care consistent for everybody, and hopefully we could do it with parity between physical and mental health issues. And drilling down a little farther, this from USA Today, LGBTQ students consider quitting college at an alarming rate. Why mental health help is hard to find. More than 1 in 4 LGBTQ college students have considered dropping out of school because of mental health challenges, a new survey shows. And a vast majority of LGBTQ students, 92%, say their mental health status has negatively impacted some part of their college experience. The survey by education research and college ranking website bestcolleges.com found fewer LGBTQ graduates would be harmful to all parts of society. We know for a fact how beneficial all kinds of diversity is to a workforce and to push innovation in all industries. So if we're seeing less of these students completing college, less of them in the workforce, it's like we're going back. It's like we're regressing. The survey comes as more young people are embracing new identities. A recent Gallup poll found that 21% of Generation Z Americans, those born from 1997 to 2003, and a group that makes up the majority of college students now, identify as LGBTQ. The challenges include being disconnected from supportive social networks, coming out to new friends and peers, and struggling to find LGBTQ-affirming spaces on campus. In the survey, students cited financial barriers, difficulty getting appointments, and a lack of LGBTQ counselors as the top obstacles preventing them from seeking mental health assistance. When you really drill down, that's a concern that we hear most often from LGBTQ youth, that some providers are not trained to support the unique issues that they may be facing. They're there to receive quality care, but instead they often have to educate their care providers about their identities. And I often hear as well that fear of discrimination when accessing care can lead students to choose not to get care. Addressing mental health challenges requires preventive measures, including working to make all campus spaces affirming for LGBTQ community members. Colleges and universities can also support LGBTQ students by providing cultural competence training for professors, administrators, and staff to ensure that they have allies across campus. Inclusive campuses also allow students to have their preferred or chosen name in student registries and provide gender-inclusive housing and LGBTQ resource centers on campus, advocates say. I think that LGBTQ health and well-being is often delegated to the counseling center or to the LGBTQ centers that are on campus. It needs to be elevated as a priority campus-wide. We need heightened awareness of the fact that if we care about student mental health, we care about LGBTQ students' inclusion and belonging. Okay, next up on the role of law enforcement in mental health, this from Science Daily. A new study shows benefits to dispatching mental health specialists in nonviolent 911 emergencies. As U.S. cities rethink the role of law enforcement in nonviolent 911 emergencies, new Stanford research uncovers the strongest evidence yet that dispatching mental health professionals instead of police officers in some instances can have significant benefits. The study of a pilot 911 response program in Denver, in which mental health specialists responded to calls involving trespassing and other nonviolent events, finds a 34% drop in reported crimes during a six-month trial. The study by Stanford scholars Thomas D. and James Pine also shows that the direct costs of the alternative 911 approach were four times lower than police-only responses. We provide strong, credible evidence that providing mental health support in targeted, nonviolent emergencies can result in a huge reduction in less serious crimes without increasing violent crime, says D., a professor at the Stanford Graduate School of Education and a senior fellow at the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. In our politically divisive times, D says, this first responder innovation provides a rare opportunity for consensus on meaningfully improving public safety and health. Several cities, including New York, Austin, San Francisco, San Mateo, California, and Washington, D.C., are experimenting with new ways to respond to certain types of mental health emergencies through little or no law enforcement involvement. According to Dee and Pine, cities have been motivated by not only high-profile cases of police brutality, but also estimates that police spend more time responding to low-priority calls than any other type of emergency. Those estimates, they write, suggest that as many as two-thirds of these types of 911 calls could be directed to mental health experts. Let the police do what they're supposed to do, defund the rest, and move those resources to actual mental health service providers. Okay, and moving to mental health in the workplace, this from Fortune. Workplace mental health benefits can reduce sick days, increase productivity, and even provide savings for employers. Two-thirds of Americans, 66%, have experienced some anxiety or depression-related symptoms over the last 6 months, according to a recent Fortune survey conducted by the Harris Poll at the end of May. And roughly 3 in 10 Americans say their overall mental health has been worse since the COVID-19 pandemic started in 2020. About 38% specifically call out higher stress levels, while 28% report worsening depression. The effects of mental health issues, particularly depression, can be extensive, not only for patients, but their families and even employers. Workers with ongoing depression are typically 35% less productive. Plus, the cost of absenteeism, reduced productivity, and medical expenses related to ongoing and unresolved depression totals an estimated $211 billion per year, according to data from the American Psychiatric Association. Since the start of the pandemic, many employers have boosted their mental health support offerings as millions of Americans face levels of stress, anxiety, depression, and burnout. But there are some questions on whether these programs actually yielded results. New research finds that employer-sponsored behavioral health programs do actually help move the needle in a positive direction. Researchers at Spring Health conducted a three-year study using data from over 1,100 employees at 66 employers across 40 states. The study, published in JAMA Network Open, found that a comprehensive employer-sponsored online mental health benefit resulted in 25% fewer missed workdays and a 24% increase in productivity. Nearly 70% of the Spring Health users evaluated reported a reliable improvement in their mental health, and it only took an average of 6 weeks for patients to enter remission of their symptoms. It's really important that we take this the validation seriously. I think that mental health sometimes is like a feel-good thing, but the reality on the ground is pretty different. People have pretty serious problems, Adam Chekroud, co-founder and president of Spring Health, tells Fortune. The study specifically evaluated Spring Health's platform, which includes a digital mental health screening, telephone and video appointments, on-demand digital self-help tools, and free or low-cost access to video or in-person psychotherapy and medication management. In addition to the health and productivity benefits, the study revealed that mental health benefits improved retention for employers. Spring Health users were 1.6 times less likely to leave their job. But what about the cost? A program like Spring Health, for example, can range from $3 or $4 per worker per month at larger corporations to $12 to $13 for smaller employers. The study found, however, that employers reap an average of more than $7,000 in estimated workplace productivity savings per participant within the first 6 months. Employers will make money, even on a workforce that is entirely federal minimum wage. Well, you are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM, We Act Radio. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, let's move to another healthcare issue. This from NBC News. Hospitals are required to post prices for common procedures. Few do. Few hospitals are posting the prices of their common procedures online, despite a federal law that went into effect more than a year ago. The hospital price transparency law is intended to make the hidden costs of services such as x-rays, medical tests, or colonoscopies clear to patients before they enter the hospital. But a study published last Tuesday in the Journal of the American Medical Association added to mounting evidence that hospitals are largely ignoring the law. The law requires hospitals to list the cash prices for procedures on their websites in two forms. One that is easily accessible for patients and that includes a cost estimator for the 300 most common services, and another that is machine readable, essentially a spreadsheet, that allows patients to know exactly what they should expect to pay and lets them compare the reduced cash prices with the prices they would pay if they went through insurance. The report analyzed 5,000 hospitals nationwide and found that just 300, or fewer than 6%, were fully compliant with the rule, meaning they had publicly published both machine-readable files and separate price estimators for shoppable items. Many hospitals were partly compliant, but 50% had neither of the two required components. A recent audit that included 1,000 randomly selected hospitals found that as early as this year, 99.5% of hospitals owned by the three largest hospital systems in the world, HCA Healthcare, Common Spirit Health, and Ascension, aren't abiding by the new law. No hospital with HCA Healthcare, the largest system in the country, was compliant by early 2022. Many procedures done in hospitals are elective or are scheduled ahead of time, which means patients have time to shop around and compare prices. Cynthia Fisher, the founder and chairman of PatientRightsAdvocate.org, that's PatientRightsAdvocate.org, might want to remember that one, the organization that conducted the audit, said the law is supposed to create competition, resulting in reduced cost of care for patients. Hospitals have been able to keep patients in the dark, blindsiding them with outrageously overcharged medical bills, Fisher said. Hospital executives are putting profits over patients by being able to not comply with this rule. Hospitals found to be non-compliant are supposed to be subject to a minimum fine of $300 and a maximum of $5,500 per day. Secretary Becerra noted that Health and Human Services has raised the penalty this year, but no hospital has been fined. Instead, Health and Human Services has issued hundreds of warning letters to non-compliant hospitals. Becerra said the letters are required before the agency can issue fines. Becerra said the agency is relying on the public to report hospitals. We need people to report this to us so we know which are the facilities that aren't complying with the law. Yeah, well, maybe we should have the police not investigate crimes and rely just on reports. Oh my goodness, that is very weak. Okay, but hot off the press, there are some fines coming with this. This from MedPage Today. The Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services slaps first hospitals with fines for lack of price transparency. This week, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, handed down their first penalties to two hospitals in Georgia for failing to comply with the price transparency law that went into effect January 1st, 2021. The hospitals were fined $883,000 and $214,000, respectively, based on the number of days they were not compliant with the law and a set amount per hospital beds per day. Both had previously received warning notices, requests for, quote, corrective action plans, and received technical assistance calls and emailed recaps from CMS from May 2021 to January 2022, but did not take steps to post online price lists that met the requirements. According to letters from CMS to the hospitals, during the technical assistance calls, representatives from the hospitals, quote, confirmed that the previous violations had not been corrected and, in fact, the hospital system had intentionally removed all previously posted pricing files. CMS has issued 352 warning notices to hospitals who were out of compliance and 157 corrective action plan requests. 171 hospitals have addressed the citations and closed their cases, according to a CMS spokesperson. With so many non-compliant hospitals to choose from, it's unclear why CMS chose the Northside Hospital to fine first. CMS did not address this question in their emailed statement, and MedPage Today has not yet heard back from the Northside Hospital System for comment by the time of publication. Both hospitals must pay the penalty within 60 days, but can appeal the civil monetary penalty decision by requesting a hearing within 30 days. If they don't pay, the non-compliance fees will continue to accrue until the hospital corrects their pricing information and notifies CMS. Okay, and more big healthcare news. This from Kaiser Health News. Medicaid weighs attaching strings to nursing home payments to improve patient care. The Biden administration is considering a requirement that the nation's 15,500 nursing homes spend most of their payments for Medicaid on direct care for residents and limit the amount that is used for operations, maintenance, and capital improvements or diverted to profits. If adopted, it would be the first time the federal government insists that nursing homes devote the majority of Medicaid dollars to caring for residents. Medicaid, the federal state health insurance program for low-income people, pays the bills for 62% of long-term residents in nursing homes. In 2019, that totaled $51 billion. Medicare, which covers short-term nursing home visits for older people or people with disabilities, spent $38 billion that year. Officials have not included Medicare payments in their discussions of a direct care spending mandate. Studies have found a strong connection between staffing levels and care. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services doesn't require specific numbers of nurses and other staff members, although some states do. In April, the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine endorsed the direct care spending strategy in a report about improving nursing home care. When you're taking public dollars, those dollars should be put back into direct care, said David Grabowski, a professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School and a member of the committee that wrote the report. We're expecting that the nursing home will make the best judgment as to the right kind of share of spending on labor and materials and capital to really produce the highest level of quality, but that just hasn't been the case. So this recommendation is really an opportunity to put up some guardrails. Although a spending mandate is new for nursing homes in three states, it has become routine for health insurers nationwide. Under the Affordable Care Act, a medical loss ratio provision where healthcare companies must spend at least 80% of premiums on beneficiaries' medical care. A maximum of 20% can be spent on administrative costs, executive salaries, advertising, and profits. Companies that exceed that limit must refund the difference to beneficiaries. So it's not something new. It's just being expanded to other huge federal spending on healthcare. Should probably integrate all this and just do single-payer healthcare. Healthcare for all.
It started in Norway in 1912. And they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, let's move to another area of government oversight, this from Food Politics. The FDA is not involved in approving most food chemicals, says Environmental Working Group. The watchdog Environmental Working Group has analyzed the approval process for new food chemicals. Its disturbing conclusions? Nearly 99% of all food chemicals introduced since 2000 were green-lighted for use by the food and chemical industry, not by the Food and Drug Administration, the agency responsible for ensuring food is safe. That's because food and chemical companies exploited a loophole in the law, allowing them to decide which chemicals are safe to consume, contrary to what Congress intended when it enacted food chemical laws in 1958. For 756 of 766 new food chemicals added to the food supply since 2000, or 98.7%, these companies have exploited a loophole for substances that are called generally recognized as safe, or GRAS. The loophole lets them, not the FDA, decide a substance is safe. I don't know if it's even fair to call that a loophole when almost all the people can go through it. Yikes, that's blowing a hole in your colon of regulation. Well, a little bit better news, this from the Environmental Defense Fund. FDA agrees to reconsider safety of BPA in food packaging. The Food and Drug Administration agreed to reconsider the safety of using bisphenol A, BPA, in polycarbonate plastics, metal can coatings, and other materials that contact food, potentially setting the stage for strict new limits on the harmful chemical. FDA's decision comes in response to a food additive petition filed by a coalition of physicians, scientists, and public health and environmental organizations. The law requires the FDA to make a final decision by October 31st of this year. And in some more news of progress, this from Kaiser Health News, an arm and a leg, good news for your credit report. Credit reporting bureaus announced in March that they would start taking most paid medical debt off people's credit reports. At first, we weren't sure that would be such a big deal. After all, the unpaid medical debt would still exist. People would still get harassed by debt collectors or even get sued over it. But as it turns out, there's a bunch of reasons these changes could be life-changing, and we want to give credit, the good kind, where it's due. The changes include paid-off medical debt disappears from credit reports on July 1st of this year. Debts under $500, even if you haven't paid them, come off reports in March of 2023. Medical bills under $500 that you received after March 1st of this year will not go onto your credit report. No medical bills of any size will appear in your credit report until they're at least a year old starting July 1st of 2022. So it allows you a little bit of space to kind of deal with these debts. Of course, if you don't have the money, it's eventually going to be a problem. Okay, well, next up, another example of a regulatory fiasco, this one about baby food from Associated Press. Many baby formula plants weren't inspected because of COVID, weren't inspected. U.S. regulators have historically inspected baby formula plants at least once a year, but they did not inspect any of the three biggest manufacturers in 2020, according to federal records reviewed by the Associated Press. And when they finally did get inside an Abbott Nutrition formula plant in Michigan after a two-year gap, they found standing water and lack sanitation procedures. But inspectors offered only voluntary suggestions for fixing the problems and issued no formal warning. Inspectors would return 5 months later after four infants who consumed powdered formula from the plant suffered bacterial infections. They found bacterial contamination inside the factory, leading to a four-month shutdown and turning a festering supply shortage into a full-blown crisis that sent parents scrambling to find formula and forced the U.S. to airlift products from overseas. And I'll just note that they're just now saying that this probably killed nine babies due to this contamination from this one plant. As COVID-19 swept across the U.S. in early 2020, the FDA pulled most of its safety inspectors from the field, skipping thousands of routine plant inspections. The FDA did conduct more than 800, quote, mission-critical inspections during the first year of the pandemic, the agency said in a statement. Regulators selected facilities for inspections based on whether they carried a specific safety risk or were needed to produce an important medical therapy. Only three of the nation's 23 facilities that make, package, or distribute formula made the cut. The FDA resumed routine inspections in July of last year. The inspection records reviewed by the Associated Press shows gaps as large as 2.5 years between FDA's 2019 inspections and when regulators returned to plants owned by the three leading formula manufacturers, Abbott, Reckitt, and Gerber. In fact, the FDA still has yet to return to one key plant owned by Reckitt and two owned by Gerber, according to agency records. All those facilities are operating around the clock to boost U.S. formula production. The FDA shares oversight of food production and safety with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. FDA inspection of food facilities peaked in 2011 and has declined most years since, despite increased funds and powers given by Congress. Okay, next up, another regulatory fiasco. This time, drug prices for the most vulnerable. This from Stat News. Pursuit of profits is driving drug companies to break the 340B law. 17 drug companies, including some of the world's largest, are flouting a 30-year-old federal program that supports hospitals serving patients with low incomes and those who live in rural communities. Both the Trump and Biden administrations have deemed these actions unlawful, but these drug makers continue to ignore the law, sapping resources from the nation's healthcare safety net and threatening the health of the patients who rely on it for care. The program in question is the 340B drug pricing program, named after the section of federal law that created it. Congress enacted 340B in 1992 in a bipartisan effort to provide safety net providers resources to serve more patients in need and provide comprehensive services they otherwise would not be able to offer. The law requires drug companies to offer discounted prices to eligible safety net providers on certain outpatient drugs. In return, Congress approved having Medicaid and Medicare Part B cover the participating company's products, a deal that has been highly lucrative for drug makers. In 2010, lawmakers moved to expand the program to include more than 1,000 small rural hospitals, along with freestanding children's and cancer facilities. The 340B program has worked as Congress intended. Hospitals that qualify for the program based on their low-income patient populations, known as disproportionate share hospitals, represent about 43% of all hospitals in the U.S., but provide 75% of hospital care for people covered by Medicaid and 60% of all uncompensated and unreimbursed care. The program also serves as a lifeline for small rural hospitals that are the only source of care for patients in remote areas. And 340B hospitals accomplish this without expending a dollar of taxpayer money. The resources instead come from the discounts drug makers provide at the point of sale. What is driving drug companies to ignore the law? As with many of the industry's actions, the motivation seems to be solely to maximize prices and profits. Many of the early adopters of these restrictive policies appear to be driven by a desire to avoid penalties mandated by Congress on drug companies that increase the prices of their drugs faster than inflation. The 340B statute requires a minimum 23% discount on brand name drugs. If a company repeatedly hikes the price of a drug, the 340B discount increases along with it. In cases of repeated price hikes, the discount can approach 100% and the 340B price can drop to a penny per dose. Insulin is a perfect example of this phenomenon. Between 1996 and 2019, Eli Lilly raised the price of Humalog, its top-selling insulin product, by 1,200%, vastly exceeding inflation. As a result, the 340B price dropped to pennies per dose. The three major insulin makers in the U.S., Eli Lilly, Novo Nordisk, and Sanofi, were among the first companies to adopt unlawful 340B pricing restrictions. By refusing to honor the 340B price for drugs dispensed at community pharmacies, those companies are circumventing the penalty Congress created, further increasing their profits on insulin and a long list of other products. By skirting the inflation penalty, companies also have fewer curbs on their overall pricing behavior. Independent research published in JAMA Network Open has demonstrated that the 340 inflation penalty slows price increases for drugs sold to all purchasers, not just 340B providers. The study looked at 606 brand-name drugs used by Medicare beneficiaries between 2013 and 2017 and found that higher percentages of drug sales subject to inflation penalties were associated with smaller drug price increases. These lower price increases were associated with a reduction in the Medicare Part D pharmacy expenditures of $7 billion over the 4-year period. The pharmaceutical industry is among the most profitable industries in the world. Between 2000 and 2018, drug companies generated $8.6 trillion in profits. Yet 17 companies, AbbVie, Amgen, AstraZeneca, Boehringer Ingelheim, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Eli Lilly, Exelixis, Gilead, GlaxoSmithKline, Johnson & Johnson, Merck, Novartis, Novo Nordisk, Pfizer, Sanofi, USB, and United Therapeutics are looking for ways to boost profits even more at the expense of the healthcare safety net, and others could do so if the dispute isn't settled soon. So far, seven companies refused to restore discounts and have been referred to the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General, which will assess whether they should face penalties for, quote, knowingly and intentionally overcharging hospitals for 340B drugs. In a filing with the federal court, AstraZeneca said such fines could amount to hundreds of millions of dollars in potential penalties every month for that company alone. The Office of Inspector General should impose fines on all companies refusing to restore 340B discounts. In an industry driven by the bottom line, that may be the only way to convince them to obey the law.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, if the news today is giving you a headache, this would probably fit to a couple stories here on headaches. This from Medical Express. Half of the world's population suffers from headaches. Every single day, 1 in 6 people on the planet has a headache. Half of them experience pain severe enough to be considered migraines. Headaches can be painful and disabling. Some people get headaches due to stress. Other headaches result from overusing medications like painkillers. The results published in the Journal of Headache and Pain indicate that more than half of the world's population has an active headache disorder. Headache prevalence is described as having experienced some type of headache over the past year. Further analysis revealed that just under 16% of people around the world had a headache on any given day. Approximately 7% of the global population experienced migraines on any given day, and almost 9% experienced a tension headache. The review also highlighted that the incidence of headaches varied by gender, with 17% of women suffering from migraines in a given year, compared with 9% of men. Getting headaches for 15 or more days a month was also much more common in women. Migraines are the leading cause of disability for people under the age of 50. A lot of other bodily pains increase as we approach retirement age. Migraines and headaches are most prevalent in the most active years of life. Headaches can have multiple causes, from an individual's genetics to stress, sleep problems, and overuse of medications. In another headache story, this from MedPage Today, stigma common among migraine patients. 1 in 3 people with migraines say they frequently experience migraine-related stigma, survey data showed. We identified 2 forms of stigma. Most commonly, the feelings that others minimize the burden of migraine, 29%, followed by a sense that others perceive migraine is being used for secondary gain, 15%. Increased disability risk was significant for people who experience migraine-related stigma. For people who perceive both types of stigma, secondary gain and minimizing burden, often or very often, disability risk was more than double compared with migraine patients who experience no stigma. One of the most striking findings was that people with fewer than 5 monthly headache days who experienced stigma had poorer migraine-related quality of life scores than people with more than 25 monthly headache days who didn't experience stigma. Stigma hurts. Okay, I'm going to close with health issues we don't talk about very much. This from the NIH director's blog. Advancing access to hearing healthcare. By 2050, the World Health Organization estimates that more than 700 million people, or 1 in every 10 people around the globe, will have disabling hearing loss. In the United States alone, hearing loss affects an estimated 30 million people. Hearing loss can be frustrating, isolating, and even dangerous. It is also associated with dementia, depression, anxiety, reduced mobility, and falls. Although hearing technologies such as hearing aids have improved, not everyone has equal access to these advancements. In fact, though hearing aids and other assistive devices can significantly improve quality of life, only one in four U.S. adults who could benefit from these devices has ever used one. Why? People commonly report encountering economic barriers, such as the high cost of hearing aids and limited access to hearing health care. For some, the reasons are more personal. They may not believe that hearing aids are effective, or they may worry about a perceived negative association with aging. And of course, hearing aids are not covered by Medicare. Okay, well, now it's time for the bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I reported on in this episode. I'll give you the link at the end of the list, 22 this week. First up, COVID shots for young kids are almost available. Here's what you need to know. That's for all you parents. 2, abortion pills will be crucial in a post-Roe world, but they're not the magic fix many think they are. It's about equity, equity, equity. 3, abortion poised to be a bigger voting issue than in the past. 4, the new abortion bans, almost no exceptions for rape, incest, or health. 5, if Roe is overturned, the ripples could affect in vitro fertilization and genetic testing of embryos, experts warn. 6, here's an Ohio story. Doula services could soon be covered by Medicaid after racial equity bill passes Ohio House. Those are kind of non-traditional services for pregnant women that is often used by minority women and has been shown to be effective in reducing poor pregnancy outcomes. 7, U.S. fight against opioid overdoses becomes one of racial justice. This is, as I have reported earlier, now blacks suffer more from the opioid crisis than do whites. 8, long wait for justice. People in jail face delays for mental health care before they can stand trial. 9, the flip side of toxic positivity, emotional perfectionism. And some monkeypox stories. There's a right way and a wrong way to respond to monkeypox. 11, monkeypox vaccination begins. Can the global outbreaks be contained? 12, concern grows that human monkeypox outbreak will establish virus in animals outside Africa. And this is important because it looks like there might be something different with this new strain that increases transmission from person to person, but it really gets a whole new level of problem if it gets established in animals outside Africa. So it goes between animals and people, people and animals, animals and people. Yikes, that's what endemic is called. 13, how the hard lessons of the AIDS crisis are shaping the response to the monkeypox outbreak. 14, related to that, blaming gay men for monkeypox will harm everyone. And related to that, 15, discriminatory and destigmatizing. Scientists push to rename monkeypox viruses. Naming monkeypox viruses after things or places usually creates stigma, which is a problem in public health. Public health should be non-judgmental. And of course, we did that with the COVID viruses. Now we're calling them, you know, BA2 and BA4, BA5, all that. 16, COVID funding pries open a door to improving air quality in schools. This is important because schools are typically underfunded and they need additional funds in order to improve air quality, which improves not only infectious diseases, but air quality, leading to increased learning, less absenteeism from asthma and such things. 17, COVID funding pries open a door. Oops, sorry. 17, children's vision problems often go undetected, despite calls for regular screening. And 18 is, okay, so 17 with the vision screening in children, we don't do enough of that, but there's also sometimes where we do too much screening, and 18 gets to that. Blood tests that detect cancers could lead to unnecessary treatments without saving patients' lives. 19, doubt is their product. How big tobacco, big oil, and the gun lobby market ignorance to convince people that the truth can't be known, delaying policy action. Yep, the merchants of death. 20, study discovers extensive undisclosed conflicts of interest in medical research. Reported a lot on that. There's a lot that's unreported. And one of my pet peeve fundraising things that you see on TV, 21, St. Jude stashed away $886 million in unspent revenue last year as other children's cancer nonprofits struggled to raise cash. I did look up their the amount that they spend on fundraising costs compared to the dollar that they get in, and it is way above the standard considered responsible for nonprofits. And last, but certainly not least, under the very interesting category 22, Soil Your Undies campaign asks Pennsylvanians to bury their underwear to test soil health. So if you take 100% cotton underwear and you bury it in the ground for 60 days and then dig it back out, if it's decayed, that's the way it should be. A lot of those bacteria in the ground, that's the way a healthy soil is. If it doesn't decay, you've probably got problems with your soil. You can listen to, you can view this and all the other stories at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. And go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-